The Rhino Climb. Great wumps of equatorial heat are coming up at me from off the tarmac. It's the short, rainy season in Kenya, but the sun burned off the morning dampness in minutes. I'm slathered in sunblock. The road stretches off into the distant heat haze, and my legs are settling in nicely. Dotted along the road ahead and behind me are other walkers, some striding vigorously, others appearing just to amble, but all in fact moving at the same speed. One of them is wearing a large grey sculptural edifice made out of a painted woven plastic fabric stretched over a metal frame. A large horn bobs along in front of it. The thing is a grotesque but oddly beautiful caricature of a rhinoceros moving along with swift, busy strides. The sun beats down. Lopsided lorries grind their way dangerously past us. The drivers shout and grin at our rhinoceros. When we pass, as we frequently do, lorries that have clearly just rolled over and collapsed on the side of the road, we wonder if it was anything to do with us. The other walkers have all been walking for several days now, from the shore at Mombasa, along the main highway to the truck stop at Voi, the local centre of the universe. I joined them here last night, rattling in by Land Rover from Nairobi with my sister Jane, who's been doing some work for Save the Rhino International, which is what we are all here to support. From here, we will follow the road on as the tarmac gradually peters out towards the Tanzanian border. Over the border lies Mount Kilimanjaro, the tallest mountain in the world. It is to the peak of Kilimanjaro that the expedition is intending to climb, a small bunch of Englishmen out walking miles a day in the midday sun and taking turns at wearing a large rhino costume. Mad dogs have thrown in the towel long ago. What's all this, I expect you're thinking, about the tallest mountain in the world? Everest surely deserves at least an honourable mention in this category. Well, it all depends on your point of view. Certainly, Everest stands a sturdy 29,028 feet above sea level, which is, in its way, impressive. But if you were going to climb Everest, you would probably start, if you were using a reliable guide, somewhere in the Himalayas. Anywhere in the Himalayas is pretty damn high to start with, and so, to hear some people tell it, it's just a smartish jog to do the last little bit to the actual top of Everest. The way to keep it interesting these days is to do it without oxygen, or in your underpants or something. But Kilimanjaro is not part of a widespread upheaval like Everest. It was a long time before people managed to work out which bit of the Himalayas was actually the highest, and the discovery was finally made, as I recall, on a desk in London. No such problem with Kilimanjaro. It's volcanic, and stands on its own surrounded by a few footling little hills. When you finally get to see Kili, searching among the befuddling clouds on the horizon, your blood suddenly runs cold. "Oh," you say at last, "you mean above the clouds?" Your whole head tilts upwards. Oh, my God! From base to apex, it is the tallest mountain in the world. It's certainly a hell of a thing to climb in a rhino costume. This crackpot idea was first put to me months earlier by the founders of Save the Rhino International, David Sterling and Johnny Roberts, and I didn't realize at first that they meant it. They raved on for a bit about having acquired a whole set of rhino costumes that Ralph Steadman had designed for an opera, and that they would be just the thing for making the ascent of Kilimanjaro in. They had already been used, David told me by way of reassurance, for running in the New York Marathon. "It'll have enormous impact," they said. "Believe me, really." I began to realize the truth of this as we approached our first village of the day, and perhaps now would be a good point to explain what the purpose of the whole expedition was. It was not, in fact, to raise money directly for rhino conservation. Rhinos, which used to be plentiful on the plains of East Africa, are now hideously rare, but in Kenya they are about as well conserved as they can be anywhere in Africa. Richard Leakey's Kenya Wildlife Service consists of 8,000 well-trained, well-equipped, well-armed, highly motivated soldiers and represents a formidable force. Too formidable, some of his opponents feel. Poaching in Kenya is, officially, no longer a problem. But conservation is a continually evolving business, and we have begun to realize that just wading into Africa and telling the local people that they mustn't do to their wildlife what we've done to ours, and that we are there to make sure they don't, is an attitude that, to say the least, needs a little refining. The communities that live along the margins of the great national parks have a tough time. They are poor, undernourished, their lands are restricted by the parks, and when, from time to time, the odd lion or elephant breaks out of the park, they are the ones who suffer. Arguments about preserving the genetic diversity of the planet can seem a little abstract to someone who has just lost the crops he needs to feed his family, or worse, has just lost one of his family. In the long run, conservation can't be imposed by outsiders, overriding the needs of local people. If anyone is going to take care of the wildlife, then, in the end, it must be the local people, and someone must take care of them. Our route took us alongside and sometimes through the great national parks of Tsavo East and Tsavo West, and it was the people who lived on these perimeters that we had come to visit and also to help. The £100,000 we were hoping to raise from the walk would be spent on building school classrooms, stocking libraries, and paying for other community projects. We wanted to encourage them to see that whatever problems the wildlife may pose to them, it was of benefit to them as well. As we were approaching our first village of the day, the rhino, with Todd Jones inside it, was in the lead. All the walkers took turns at wearing the thing for an hour at a time, and you quickly learned to tell who was in it at any moment from the way in which it moved. If the rhino sauntered, then it was Giles inside. Giles was an ex-Gordonston Hugh Grant lookalike who had spent the last few years hitchhiking languidly around Africa with his own parachute. His technique was to turn up at airfields with this parachute, find someone who was flying in the general direction he wanted to go, hitch a lift, and then, when the fancy took him, just jump out of the plane. Apparently, his girlfriend was a top supermodel who every few months would find out where he was, fly out there, and then, I'm guessing here, have him washed and sent up to her hotel room. If the rhino ambled along in a genial way, then it was Tom inside. Tom was a tall, Woodhousian man with exactly the wrong complexion for Africa. He had the amiable air of a member of the landed gentry, and when I asked him where he lived, he said in a vague kind of way, "Shropshire." If the rhino bustled along busily, it was Todd inside. Todd was not a mad Englishman, because he was Welsh. He was in charge of the rhino costumes, and had worn them originally in the opera for which they had been designed, during which he had had to carry enormously heavy sopranos on his back. He told me that he had originally wanted to be a vet, but had ended up instead being a succession of animals instead. Any time you see a film or TV show or a commercial which features someone dressed up as an animal, it's probably Todd inside. "I was in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe," he told me. "Guess," he added, "which one I was." One evening he showed me pictures of his family. Here was a beautiful picture of his wife, another of his young daughter, a sweet picture of his baby son, and here was one of Todd himself. Todd was done up, very convincingly, as a bright blue centaur. As Todd Rhino bustled along, suddenly huge crowds of children erupted onto the road ahead of us and hurried towards us, singing and dancing and chanting, "Rhino! Rhino! Rhino!" We were quickly surrounded and escorted the last few hundred yards to where they had prepared a reception for us in the village square. The whole village had turned out to greet us with enormous enthusiasm. We sat and watched, panting in the heat and sluicing ourselves down with bottled water, as the children of the village put on a display of dancing and choral singing that was, frankly, amazing. When I say children, I'm not just talking about 7-year-olds. I'm talking about 17-year-olds as well. It's odd that we don't any more have a comfortable word that covers the whole range. Youngsters? Patronizing. Kids? No. Youths? Sounds as if they've just broken into a warehouse and stolen something. Children, then. The children had written a song about rhinos, which they then sang for us. In the background, Giles had quietly taken over from Todd in the rhino suit, and after a while he joined in the dancing, lolloping and swaying around, chasing and playing with the children, before finally dodging off behind a tree for a quick ciggy. We then, with slightly less enthusiasm, sat through a series of speeches that some local dignitaries had turned up to deliver. Wherever we went, there were local dignitaries, keen to be seen, to be associated with us. Gradually, the whole point of the rhino suit was beginning to dawn on me. The arrival of the rhino and the rhino climb team was something that the village had been looking forward to and preparing for months. It was the biggest event of the year, a carnival, a festival, a holiday. Being visited by a rhino was something that would be remembered by the villagers, and particularly the children, for years in a way that being visited by a bunch of English toffs in hats would not. We were then taken to see the village school. Like most of the village, it was made of breeze blocks and was half-finished. The doors and windows were empty holes, the furniture was just a few rickety benches and some trestle tables, and laid out on these were dozens of pictures of the local wildlife which the children had drawn, and which we were to judge and give prizes for. The prizes were rhino climb baseball hats, and whoever won the prizes, we had to make sure that every member of the village actually got a hat. and once we have collected our sponsorship money, we will be able to complete the building of their schoolroom for them. When at last we left, the children danced along with us for several miles, laughing and singing improvised songs. One of them would start, and the others would quickly pick it up and join in. The words seem oddly dated, don't they? It all sounds rather naive and sentimental to be talking about children laughing and dancing and singing together, when we all know perfectly well that what children do in real life is snarl and take drugs. But these children, kids, youths, and all the ones we came across on our journey were happy in a way that we in the West are almost embarrassed by. The last of the children drops away from us. Our support Land Rover drives slowly past, distributing Cokes and Fantas. Jim, our photographer, is sitting on its tailgate, taking pictures of us with his Canon EOS 1, which I've been coveting ever since I saw it. Kees, our Dutch video cameraman, hoists his lightweight Sony 3-chip up to his shoulder and pans along the line of walkers. I wonder if there's anywhere in the West that you could find 100 children to sing and dance like that. The following day is my first stint in the rhino suit. I'm much too big for it, and my legs stick out absurdly from the bottom, so that I look like a giant prawn tempura. Inside, the heat and the stench of stale sweat and old Dettol are almost overpowering until you get into the swing of things. Todd walks along beside me, determinedly keeping me engaged in conversation. After a while, I realize he's monitoring me to make sure I don't faint. Todd's a good man, and I like him a lot. He takes good care of people and takes even better care of his beloved rhino suit. I stop for a moment to pour some water into and over my face and catch a glimpse of myself in the window of the Land Rover. I look unimaginably stupid, and I reflect that there is something very odd about this sponsored walking business. It's always undertaken for good causes, cancer research, famine relief, wildlife conservation, and so on, but the deal seems to be this. Okay, you are trying to raise funds for this very worthwhile cause, and I can see that it's an important and crucial matter, and that lives or indeed whole species are at stake, and something needs to be done as a matter of urgency. But, well, I don't know. Tell you what, do something really pointless and stupid and maybe a bit dangerous, then I'll give you some money. I only spent a week on the walk. I didn't get to climb Kilimanjaro, though I did get to see it. I was very sorry not to get to go up it. Though, having seen it, I have to say I wasn't very, very sorry. I did get to see one rhino, briefly, out of the thousands that used to roam in this area, and I wondered if it had any sense at all that all was not right with its world. Human beings have been on this planet for 1 million years or so, and in that time we have faced all sorts of threats to our survival. Famine, plague, warfare, AIDS. Rhinoceroses have been here for 40 million years, and just one threat has brought them to the brink of extinction. Human beings. We are not the only species to have caused devastation to the rest of the world, and it must be said in our favour that we are the only one that has become aware of the consequences of its behaviour and tried to do something about it. However, I reflect as I shift the costume back into a comfortable walking posture and squint forward over its bobbing plastic horn, we do go about it in some odd ways. 1993, Completely Unexpected Productions Limited. For children only. You will need to know the difference between Friday and a fried egg. It's quite a simple difference, but an important one. Friday comes at the end of the week, whereas a fried egg comes out of a hen. Like most things, of course, it isn't quite that simple. The fried egg isn't properly a fried egg until it's been put in a frying pan and fried. This is something you wouldn't do to a Friday, of course, though you might do it on a Friday. You can also fry eggs on a Thursday, if you like, or on a cooker. It's all rather complicated, but it makes a kind of sense if you think about it for a while. It's also good to know the difference between a lizard and a blizzard. This is quite an easy one. Though the two things sound very much alike, you find them in such very different parts of the world that it is a very simple matter to tell them apart. If you are somewhere inside the Arctic Circle, then what you are looking at is probably a blizzard. Whereas, if you are in a hot and dry place like Madagascar or Mexico, it's more likely to be a lizard. This animal is a lemur. There are lots of different kinds of lemurs, and they nearly all live in Madagascar. Madagascar is an island, a very large island, much, much larger than your hat, but not as large as the moon. The moon is much larger than it appears to be. This is worth remembering because next time you are looking at the moon, you can say in a deep and mysterious voice, "The moon is much larger than it appears to be." and people will know that you are a wise person who has thought about this a lot. This particular kind of lemur is called a ring-tailed lemur. Nobody knows why it is called this, and generations of scientists have been baffled by it. One day, a very wise person indeed will probably work out why it is called a ring-tailed lemur. If this person is exceedingly wise, then he or she will only tell very close friends in secret, because otherwise everybody will know it, and then nobody will realize how wise the first person to know it really was. Here are two more things you should know the difference between: road and woad. One is a thing that you drive along in a car or on a bicycle, and the other is a kind of blue body paint that British people used to wear thousands of years ago instead of clothes. Usually it's quite easy to tell these two apart, but if you find it at all difficult to say your R's properly, it can lead to terrible confusion. Imagine trying to ride a bicycle on a small patch of blue paint, or have to dig up an entire street just to have something to wear if you fancy spending the evening with some druids. Druids used to live thousands of years ago. They used to wear long white robes and have very strong opinions about what a wonderful thing the sun was. Do you know what an opinion is? I expect someone in your family has probably got one, so you could ask them to tell you about it. Asking people about their opinions is a very good way of making friends. Telling them about your own opinions can also work, but not always quite as well. Nowadays, most people know what a wonderful thing the sun is, so there aren't many druids around anymore, but there are still a few, just in case it slips our mind from time to time. If you find someone who has a long white robe and talks about the sun a lot, then you might have found a druid. If he turns out to be about 2,000 years old, then that's a sure sign. If the person you found has got a slightly shorter white coat with buttons up the front, then it may be that he is an astronomer and not a druid. If he is an astronomer, then one of the things you could ask him is how far away the sun is. The answer will probably startle you a lot. If it doesn't, then tell him from me that he hasn't explained it very well. After he's told you how far away the sun is, ask him how far away some of the stars are. That will really surprise you. If you can't find an astronomer yourself, then ask your parents to find one for you. They don't all wear white coats, which is one of the things that sometimes makes them hard to spot. Some of them wear jeans or even suits. When we say that something is startling, we mean that it surprises us a very great deal. When we say that something is a starling, we mean that it is a type of migratory bird. Bird is a word we use quite often, which is why it's such an easy word to say. Most of the words we use often, like house and car and tree, are easy to say. Migratory is a word we don't use nearly so much, and saying it can sometimes make you feel as if your teeth are stuck together with toffee. If birds were called migratories rather than birds, we probably wouldn't talk about them nearly so much. We all say, look, there's a dog, or there's a cat. But if a migratory went by, we'd probably just say, is it tea time yet? And not even mention it, however nifty it looked. But migratory doesn't mean that something is stuck together with toffee, however much it sounds like it. It means that something spends part of the year in one country and part of it in another. Brandenburg number 5. Whatever new extremities of discovery or understanding we reach, we always seem to find the footsteps of Bach there already. When we see images of the strange mathematical beasts lurking at the heart of the natural world, fractal landscapes, the infinitely unfolding Paisley worlds of the Mandelbrot set, the Fibonacci series, which describes the pattern of leaves growing on the stem of a plant, the strange attractors that beat at the heart of chaos, it is always the dizzying, complex spirals of Bach that come to mind. Some people say that the mathematical complexity of Bach renders it unemotional. I think the opposite is true. As I listen to the interplay of parts in a piece of Bach polyphony, each individual strand of music gathers hold of a different feeling in my mind and takes them on simultaneous, interweaving roller coasters of emotion. One part may be quietly singing to itself, another on an exhilarating rampage. Another is sobbing in the corner, another dancing. Arguments break out, laughter, rage, peace is restored. The parts can be utterly different, yet all belong indivisibly together. It's as emotionally complex as a family. And now, as we discover that each individual mind is a family of different parts, all working separately, but together to create the fleeting shimmers we call consciousness, it seems that once again, Bach was there before us. When you listen to the fifth Brandenburg Concerto, you don't need a musicologist to tell you that something new and different is happening. Even 2¾ centuries after it actually was new, you can hear the unmistakable thrumming energy of a master at the height of his powers doing something wild and daring with absolute self-confidence. When Bach wrote it, he put himself at the harpsichord instead of the viola he more usually played in ensembles. It was at a happy, productive time of his life when he was at last surrounded by some good musicians. The harpsichord, traditionally, played a supporting role in this kind of group, but not this time. Bach let rip. As you listen to the first movement, you hear something strange, new and terrifying, giving birth to itself. Or maybe it's a giant engine, or even a great horse being prepared for a Herculean task, surrounded by, you can't help jumbling metaphors when language tries to keep up with music, a flotilla of helpers fussing around it. You hear it ticking over, trotting, having a little canter here and there, getting a bit frisky, and then taking a trial run as its helpers encourage it onwards, keening with bated breath. It hauls itself back in again, does another quick circuit, and then the other instruments fall silent. It stands free and alone, pawing at the ground, breathing deeply, gathering its strength, trotting forward. And then it makes its move, running, hurtling, flying, climbing, clambering, pushing, panting, twisting, thrashing, pounding at the ground, pounding, pounding, suddenly breaking away, running onwards desperately, and then with one last little unexpected step up in the bass, it's home and free. The main tune charges in triumphantly, and it's all over bar the weeping and dancing. That is, the second and third movements. The familiarity of the Brandenburgs should not blind us to their magnitude. I'm convinced that Bach is the greatest genius who ever walked among us. And the Brandenburgs are what he wrote when he was happy. Frank the Vandal. The Macintosh came out 5 years ago, and I seem to have had the builders in my house for almost that long. Someone asked me the other day what they were doing, and I explained that I had been trying to pluck up the courage to ask them that myself. Things are rather complicated by the fact that one of them is an electrician called Frank the Vandal. That is, his friends, if he has any that aren't in hospital, call him Frank, and I call him Frank the Vandal because every time he needs to get at any bit of wiring, he tends to hack his way through anything else that's in the way to get at it. Plasterwork, woodwork, plumbing, telephone lines, furniture, even other bits of wiring he's put in himself on previous raids. He is, I am assured, very good as an electrician, though I think he is maybe not very good as a human being. But I'm digressing here from the point I was trying to make and have rather lost the thread because Frank just cut the power off since I did the last save. So where was I? Ah, yes. The house was virtually a complete wreck when I bought it. Not quite as much a wreck as it is when Frank's been, but nevertheless, it was pretty much an empty shell into which walls, floors, plumbing, and so on had to be put. When the walls have to be built, an expert, or so I'm told, not so sure about that myself, but in principle, an expert bricklayer comes into the house and builds them. I need floors and stairs and cupboards and things, so a carpenter, whistling a merry carpenter's tune, comes round and plies his trade. Then a plumber comes round and dittoes. Then Frank the Vandal comes round to wrench some wiring into place, and of course the carpenter and plumber and so on have to come round again and make extensive repairs. I'm going to have to drop the subject of Frank because he's not a part of the analogy I am by slow degrees attempting elegantly to construct. It's just that he preys on my mind a bit at the moment, and it's difficult not to sit here feeling nervous while he's in the house. So forget Frank. You're lucky. You can. Now the point is this. The house is here. Building this house is the purpose of the whole exercise. If I want anything done in it, I pick up the phone, assuming Frank hasn't hacked through the line trying to get at a light switch, and someone comes round to the house and does it. If I want to have some cupboards installed, I don't have to do the following. I don't have to have the house completely dismantled, shipped up to Birmingham, where the carpenter is, put together again in a way that a carpenter understands, then have the carpenter work on it, and then have the whole thing dismantled again, shipped back down to Islington, and put together again so that it works as a house that I can live in. So why do I have to do that on my computer? Let me put that another way so that it makes sense. Why, when I'm working in a document in one word processor, do I keep on finding that if I want to do something else to the document, I have virtually to dismantle the document and ship it over to another word processor, which has a feature I need that the first one doesn't? Why don't I just use the second word processor? Well, because it doesn't have other features that the first one does, of course. Or, if I want to put a picture in it, why do I have to go off to another program entirely and do the picture there, and then go through all the mind-numbing palaver of discovering that, for some reason, the WP I'm using doesn't know how to handle graphics in that particular format, or claims that it does, but then just goes all black and sulky, or makes the machine go bing when I actually ask it to? In the end, I have to paste all the various bits into PageMaker, which then refuses to print for some reason. I know that MultiFinder has made all this a bit easier, but it's really just the equivalent of making Birmingham easier to get to, if you follow me. I don't want to know about PICT files. I don't want to know about TIFF files. I don't. They give me the willies. I don't want to have to worry about what file type to ask MacWrite 2 to save my work in so that I can get Nisus to read it and run one of its interminable macros over it. I'm a Mac user, for heaven's sake. This is meant to be easy. The Mac started out as a wonderfully simple and elegant idea. Give them so little memory that they won't be able to do anything anyway. And it's time that that degree of simplicity could be brought to bear on the much, much more powerful and complex system that the Mac has now become. What I want to be able to do is this. 1. Turn on the machine. 2. Work. 3. Have a bit of fun, provided I've done enough of 2, which is rarely, but that's another issue. When I say work, I mean I want to be able to start typing on the screen, and if I feel like putting in a drawing, I draw on the screen. Or I bring something from my scanner onto the screen, or I send something from my screen to someone else, or I get my Mac to play the tune I've just written on the screen on a synthesizer. Or, well, the list is obviously endless. And if I need any particular tool to enable me to do anything complicated, I simply ask for it. And I mean simply. I should never have to put away the thing I'm working on unless I've actually finished it. Fat chance, say my publishers. Or want to do something else entirely. What I'm talking about is the death of the application. I don't mean just when they unexpectedly quit. I mean it's time we simply got rid of them. And getting hold of the tools I need should be as simple as pasting a button into HyperCard. Ah, HyperCard. I know it's unfashionable to say this, because a lot of people feel that HyperCard simply isn't powerful enough to do useful work in. It is, after all, a first stab at an idea that's in its infancy. The list of things you can't do with it is almost as long as the list of macros in Nisus. What are all those things? The very act of pulling down the macros menu causes lights to dim all over North London. But it's a sensationally good idea, and I would dearly love to see something like it become the whole working environment for the Mac. You want the number crunching power of Excel? Paste it in. You want animation? Paste in Director. You don't like the way Director works? You must be mad, it's brilliant. Paste in the bits you like of any other animation tools you find lying about. Or even rewrite it. If it's properly written in object-oriented code, it should be as easy as writing HyperTalk. All right, you can't write HyperTalk. It should be easier to write than HyperTalk. Just point at the bits you like and click. We should not have to be tyrannized by application designers who don't know the first thing about how actual people do their actual work. We should be able to just pick up the bits we like and paste them in. I've gone on a bit about electricians. I would now like to talk about cupboards. One particular cupboard. It's a cupboard in the corner of my study, and I daren't go into it, because I know that if I go into it, I will not emerge till the end of the afternoon, and I will emerge from it a sad and embittered man who has done battle with a seething black serpentine monster and lost. The seething black serpentine monster is a 3-foot-high pile of cables, and it both taunts and haunts me. It taunts me because it knows that whatever cable it is that I want at any particular moment to connect one particular arcane device to another particular arcane device is not to be found anywhere in its tangled entrails, and it haunts me because I know it's right. I hate cables. They hate me, too, because they know that one day I will simply be able to go into that cupboard with a flamethrower and get rid of the lot of them. In the meantime, they are determined to extract from me the last ounce of frustrated misery that they can. We do not need the bastards. We should not need the bastards. Take my current situation as an example. In order to be safe from Frank the Vandal, I have transferred this article onto my portable Mac. I know you hate me. Listen, we'll all have one in the end. They'll bring the price down, trust me. Or rather, don't trust me, trust Apple. Well, yes, I see your point. Please, can I get back to what I was saying anyway, And I have taken the additional precaution of taking it round to a friend's house, which is entirely electrically isolated from anything that Frank may be up to. When I get back home with a finished piece, I can either copy it onto a floppy disk, assuming I can find one under the debris of half-finished chapters on my desk, then put it into my main Mac and print it, again assuming that Frank hasn't been near my Apple Talk network with his chainsaw, or I can try and do battle with the monster in the cupboard until I find another Apple Talk connector somewhere in its innards, or I can crawl around under my desk and disconnect Apple Talk from the 2X and connect it to the portable. Or you get the picture. This is ridiculous. Dickens didn't have to crawl around under his desk trying to match plugs. You look at the sheer yardage of Dickens' output on a shelf, and you know he never had to match plugs. All I want to do is print from my portable, poor baby. That isn't all I want, in fact. I want to be able regularly to transfer my address book and diary stacks backwards and forwards between my portable and my 2X. And all my current half-finished chapters, and anything else I'm tinkering with, which is the reason why my half-finished chapters are half-finished. In other words, I want my portable to appear on the desktop of my 2X. I don't want to have to do battle with cupboard monsters and then mess about with tops every time I want that to happen. I'll tell you all I want to have to do in order to get my portable to appear on the desktop of my 2X. I just want to carry it into the same room. Bang! There it is. It's on the desktop. This is infrared talk. Or maybe it's microwave talk. I don't really care any more than I want to care about PICTs and TIFFs and RTFs and SILKs and all the other acronyms which merely say, we've got a complicated problem, so here's a complicated answer to it. Let me make one thing clear. I adore my Macintosh. Or rather, my family of however many Macintoshes it is that I've recklessly accumulated over the years. I've adored it since I first saw one at Infocom's offices in Boston in 1983. The thing that has kept me enthralled and hypnotized by it in all that time is the perception which lies at the heart of its design, which is this. There is no problem so complicated that you can't find a very simple answer to it if you look at it the right way. Or, to put it another way, the future of computer power is pure simplicity. So my two major wishes for the 1990s are that the Macintosh systems designers get back to that future, and that Frank the Vandal gets out of my house. Written in 1989 for Mac User. Build it, and we will come. I remember the first time I ever saw a personal computer. It was at Lasky's on the Tottenham Court Road, and it was called a Commodore PET. It was quite a large pyramid shape, with a screen at the top about the size of a chocolate bar. I prowled around it for a while, fascinated, but it was no good. I couldn't for the life of me see any way in which a computer could be of any use in the life or work of a writer. However, I did feel the first tiniest inklings of a feeling that would go on to give a whole new meaning to the words disposable income. The reason I couldn't imagine what use it would be to me was that I had a very limited idea of what a computer actually was, as did we all. I thought it was a kind of elaborate adding-up machine. And that is exactly how personal computers, a misleading term as applied to almost any machine we've seen so far, were for a while developed, as super-adding machines with a long feature list. Then, as our ability to manipulate numbers with these machines became more sophisticated, we wondered what might happen if we made the numbers stand for something else, like, for instance, the letters of the alphabet. Bingo! An extraordinary, world-changing breakthrough. We realized we had been myopically short-sighted to think this thing was just an adding machine. It was something far more exciting. It was a typewriter. So we began to develop it as a super typewriter, with a long and increasingly incomprehensible feature list. Users of Microsoft Word will know what I'm talking about. The next breakthrough came when we started to make these numbers, which were now flying round inside these machines at insane speeds, stand for the picture elements of a graphical display. Pixels! Aha, we thought. This machine turns out to be much more exciting even than a typewriter. It's a television, with a typewriter stuck in front of it. And now we have the World Wide Web. The only thing I know of whose shortened form, WWW, takes three times longer to say than what it's short for. And we have yet another exciting new model. It's a brochure! A huge, all-singing, all-dancing, hopping, beeping, flash-ridden brochure. Of course, the computer isn't any of these things. These are all things we were previously familiar with from the real world, which we have modelled in the computer so that we can use the damn thing. Which should tell us something interesting. The computer is actually a modelling device. Once we see that, we ought to realise that we can model anything in it. Not just things we are used to doing in the real world, but the things the real world actually prevents us from doing. What does a brochure prevent us from doing? Well, first of all, its job is to persuade people to buy what you have to sell, and do it by being as glossy and seductive as possible, and only telling people what you want them to know. You can't interrogate a brochure. Most corporate websites are like that. Take BMW, for instance. Its website is gorgeous and whizzy, and it won't answer your questions. It won't let you find out what other people's experience of owning BMWs is like, what shortcomings any particular model might or might not have, how reliable they are, what they cost to run, what it's like in the wet, or anything like that. In other words, anything you might actually want to know. You can email them, but your question or their answer or anybody else's answer will not appear on the site. Of course, there are plenty of websites where people do share exactly that kind of information, and they're only a few clicks away, but you won't find a word about them on BMW's site. In fact, if you want proper grown-up information about BMWs, the last place you'll find is at www.bmw.com. It's a brochure. Same with British Airways. It'll tell you anything you like about British Airways flights, except who else is flying those routes. So if you want to see what the choice is, you go instead to one of the scores of other sites that will tell you. Which is bad news for British Airways, because they never get to find out what you were actually looking for, or how what they were offering stacked up against the competition. And because that is very valuable information, they have to send out teams of people with clipboards to try to find out, despite the fact that everybody lies to people with clipboards. The people who have got this spectacularly right so far are the guys at Amazon. You go to their site because it's awash with shared information. The more information there is, the more people go there. And the more people go there, the more information they generate, and the more books Amazon sell. Of course, they are not afraid of open debate because, unlike BMW, they are not responsible for the product they sell. It will take BMW and British Airways a long time and a big deep breath to realize that they are part of the community they sell to. But even Amazon has only got part of the picture. Like real-world shops, they can only record the sales they actually make. What about the sales they don't make and don't know that they haven't made because they haven't made them? I went on to Amazon the other day because I wanted to order the 1968 Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet on DVD. Turns out it doesn't exist. I could buy it on VHS, but I don't want it on VHS. So the whole transaction was null. There was no way of recording that I came in looking to buy something and that the something I wanted to buy wasn't there. I only got to select or not select from what happened to be available. I didn't get to be able to say what I actually wanted. So I wrote to them about it, and guess what? Now you can. They're very smart like that. They are now able to supply the studios with information about what there is actually demand for out there. And on the basis of another, not entirely disinterested suggestion of mine, they are going to start a running poll on which books people would most like to see turned into movies. This is information that no one has ever been able to collect before. But let us take this one stage further. How often have you looked through a brochure or a catalogue and thought, I wish somebody would write a book about... Or, if only somebody made a bicycle with a... Or, why doesn't somebody make a screwdriver that... Or, why don't they make that in blue? A brochure can't answer you, but the web can. What is the thing you'd really love to have if only someone had the sense to make one? Suggestions, please, to www.h2g2.com. Independent on Sunday. I've come up with a set of rules that describe our reactions to technologies. Rule 1. Anything that is in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary and is just a natural part of the way the world works. 2. Anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 are new and exciting and revolutionary, and you can probably get a career in it. 3. Anything invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things. Interview with American Atheists. Conducted by David Silverman. American Atheists. Mr. Adams, you have been described as a radical atheist. Is this accurate? Douglas. Yes, I think I use the term radical rather loosely, just for emphasis. If you describe yourself as atheist, some people will say, don't you mean agnostic? I have to reply that I really do mean atheist. I really do not believe that there is a God. In fact, I am convinced that there is not a God. A subtle difference. I see not a shred of evidence to suggest that there is one. It's easier to say that I am a radical atheist just to signal that I really mean it, have thought about it a great deal, and that it's an opinion I hold seriously. It's funny how many people are genuinely surprised to hear a view expressed so strongly. In England, we seem to have drifted from vague, wishy-washy Anglicanism to vague, wishy-washy agnosticism, both of which I think betoken a desire not to have to think about things too much. People will then often say, but surely it's better to remain an agnostic just in case. This, to me, suggests such a level of silliness and muddle that I usually edge out of the conversation rather than get sucked into it. If it turns out that I've been wrong all along, and there is in fact a God, and if it further turned out that this kind of legalistic, cross-your-fingers-behind-your-back, Clintonian hair-splitting impressed him, then I think I would choose not to worship him anyway. Other people will ask how I can possibly claim to know. Isn't belief that there is not a God as irrational, arrogant, etc., as belief that there is a God? To which I say no, for several reasons. First of all, I do not believe that there is not a God. I don't see what belief has got to do with it. I believe or don't believe my four-year-old daughter when she tells me that she didn't make that mess on the floor. I believe in justice and fair play, though I don't know exactly how we achieve them, other than by continually trying against all possible odds of success. I also believe that England should enter the European Monetary Union. I am not remotely enough of an economist to argue the issue vigorously with someone who is, but what little I do know, reinforced with a hefty dollop of gut feeling, strongly suggests to me that it's the right course. I could very easily turn out to be wrong, and I know that. These seem to me to be legitimate uses for the word believe. As a carapace for the protection of irrational notions from legitimate questions, however, I think that the word has a lot of mischief to answer for. So I do not believe that there is no God. I am, however, convinced that there is no God, which is a totally different stance and takes me on to my second reason. I don't accept the currently fashionable assertion that any view is automatically as worthy of respect as any equal and opposite view. My view is that the moon is made of rock. If someone says to me, well, you haven't been there, have you? You haven't seen it for yourself, so my view that it is made of Norwegian beaver cheese is equally valid. Then I can't even be bothered to argue. There is such a thing as the burden of proof, and in the case of God, as in the case of the composition of the moon, this has shifted radically. God used to be the best explanation we'd got, and we've now got vastly better ones. God is no longer an explanation of anything, but has instead become something that would itself need an insurmountable amount of explaining. So I don't think that being convinced that there is no God is as irrational or arrogant a point of view as belief that there is. I don't think the matter calls for even-handedness at all. American Atheists. How long have you been a non-believer? And what brought you to that realization? Douglas. Well, it's a rather corny story. As a teenager, I was a committed Christian. It was in my background. I used to work for the school chapel, in fact. Then one day, when I was about 18, I was walking down the street when I heard a street evangelist, and dutifully stopped to listen. As I listened, it began to be borne in on me that he was talking complete nonsense, and that I had better have a bit of a think about it. Now, I've put that a bit glibly. When I say I realized he was talking nonsense, what I mean is this. In the years I'd spent learning history, physics, Latin, math, I'd learned, the hard way, something about standards of argument, standards of proof, standards of logic, etc. In fact, we had just been learning how to spot the different types of logical fallacy, and it suddenly became apparent to me that these standards simply didn't seem to apply in religious matters. In religious education, we were asked to listen respectfully to arguments which, if they had been put forward in support of a view of, say, why the corn laws came to be abolished when they were, would have been laughed at as silly and childish, and, in terms of logic and proof, just plain wrong. Why was this? Well, in history, even though the understanding of events, of cause and effect, is a matter of interpretation, and even though interpretation is in many ways a matter of opinion, nevertheless, those opinions and interpretations are honed to within an inch of their lives in the withering crossfire of argument and counter-argument, and those that are still standing are then subjected to a whole new round of challenges of fact and logic from the next generation of historians, and so on. All opinions are not equal. Some are a very great deal more robust, sophisticated, and well-supported in logic and argument than others. So, I was already familiar with, and, I'm afraid, accepting of, the view that you couldn't apply the logic of physics to religion, that they were dealing with different types of truth. I now think this is baloney. But to continue. What astonished me, however, was the realization that the arguments in favor of religious ideas were so feeble and silly next to the robust arguments of something as interpretive and opinionated as history. In fact, they were embarrassingly childish. They were never subject to the kind of outright challenge which was the normal stock in trade of any other area of intellectual endeavor whatsoever. Why not? Because they wouldn't stand up to it. So I became an agnostic. And I thought and thought and thought. But I just did not have enough to go on, so I didn't really come to any resolution. I was extremely doubtful about the idea of God, but I just didn't know enough about anything to have a good working model of any other explanation for, well, life, the universe, and everything to put in its place. But I kept at it, and I kept reading, and I kept thinking. Sometime around my early 30s, I stumbled upon evolutionary biology, particularly in the form of Richard Dawkins' books, The Selfish Gene, and then The Blind Watchmaker. And suddenly, on, I think, the second reading of The Selfish Gene, it all fell into place. It was a concept of such stunning simplicity, but it gave rise, naturally, to all of the infinite and baffling complexity of life. The awe it inspired in me made the awe that people talk about in respect of religious experience seem frankly silly beside it. I'd take the awe of understanding over the awe of ignorance any day. American Atheists. You allude to your atheism in your speech to your fans. Quote, that was one of the few times I actually believed in God, end quote. Is your atheism common knowledge among your fans, friends, and co-workers? Are many people in your circle of friends and co-workers atheists as well? Douglas. This is a slightly puzzling question to me, and I think there is a cultural difference involved. In England, there is no big deal about being an atheist. It's just a slight twinge of discomfort about people strongly expressing a particular point of view, when maybe a detached wishy-washiness might be felt to be more appropriate. Hence a preference for agnosticism over atheism. And making the move from agnosticism to atheism takes, I think, much more commitment to intellectual effort than most people are ready to put in. But there's no big deal about it. A number of the people I know and meet are scientists, and in those circles, atheism is the norm. I would guess that most people I know otherwise are agnostics and quite a few atheists. If I was to try and look amongst my friends, family, and colleagues for people who believe there was a God, I'd probably be looking amongst the older, and, to be perfectly frank, less well-educated ones. There are one or two exceptions. I nearly put by habit honourable exceptions, but I don't really think that. American Atheists. How often have fans, friends, or co-workers tried to save you from atheism? Douglas. Absolutely never. We just don't have that kind of fundamentalism in England. Well, maybe that's not absolutely true, but, and I'm going to be horribly arrogant here, I guess I just tend not to come across such people, just as I tend not to come across people who watch daytime soaps or read the National Enquirer. And how do you usually respond? I wouldn't bother. American Atheists. Have you faced any obstacles in your professional life because of your atheism? Bigotry against atheists? And how did you handle it? How often does this happen? Douglas. Not even remotely. It's an inconceivable idea. American Atheists. There are quite a few light-hearted references to God and religion in your books. Quote, 2,000 years after some guy got nailed to a tree, end quote. How has your atheism influenced your writing? Where, in which characters or situations, are your personal religious thoughts most accurately reflected? Douglas. I am fascinated by religion. That's a completely different thing from believing in it. It has had such an incalculably huge effect on human affairs. What is it? What does it represent? Why have we invented it? How does it keep going? What will become of it? I love to keep poking and prodding at it. I've thought about it so much over the years that that fascination is bound to spill over into my writing. American Atheists. What message would you like to send to your atheist fans? Douglas. Hello. How are you? From The American Atheist, Volume 37, Number 1. What are the benefits of speaking to your fans via email? It's quicker, easier, and involves less licking. Predicting the future. Trying to predict the future is a mug's game, but increasingly it's a game we all have to play, because the world is changing so fast, and we need to have some idea of what the future's actually going to be like, because we're going to have to live there, probably next week. Oddly, the industry, which is the primary engine of this incredible pace of change, the computer industry, turns out to be rather bad at predicting the future itself. There are two things in particular that it failed to foresee. One was the coming of the Internet, which, in astonishingly short time, has become what the computer industry is now all about. The other was the fact that the century would end. So, as we stand on the brink of a new millennium, peering up at the shiny cliff face of change that confronts us, like Kubrick's apes gibbering in front of the great black monolith, how can we possibly hope to guess what's to come? Molecular computers? Quantum computers? What can we dare to say about them? We were wrong about trains. We were wrong about planes. We were wrong about radio. We were wrong about phones. We were wrong about... Well, for a voluminous list of the things we have been wrong about, you could do worse than dig out a copy of a book called The Expert Speak by Christopher Cerf and Victor Navasky. It's a compendium of authoritative predictions made in the past which turned out to be wonderfully wrong, usually almost immediately. You know the kind of thing. Irving Fisher, professor of economics at Yale University, said on October the 17th, 1929, that stocks have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. Then there was the Decca Record executive who said of the Beatles in 1962, "We don't like their sound. Groups of guitars are on their way out." And so on. Ah, here's another one. "Bill Clinton will lose to any Republican who doesn't drool on stage," said the Wall Street Journal in 1995. It's a very fat book you can read happily in the loo for hours. The odd thing is that we don't get any better at it. We smile indulgently when we hear that Lord Kelvin said in 1897, "Radio has no future." But it's more surprising to discover that Ken Olson, the president of the Digital Equipment Corporation, said in 1977, "There is no reason for any individual to have a computer in their home." Even Bill Gates, who specifically set out to prove him completely and utterly wrong, famously said that he couldn't conceive of anybody needing more than 640K of memory in their computers. Try running Word in even 20 times that. It would be interesting to keep a running log of predictions and see if we can spot the absolute corkers when they are still just pert little buds. One such that I spotted recently was a statement made in February by a Mr. Wayne Luke, vice president of engineering at US West, the American phone company. Arguing against the deployment of high-speed wireless data connections, he said, "Granted, you could use it in your car going 60 miles an hour, but I don't think too many people are going to be doing that." Just watch. That's a statement that will come back to haunt him. Satellite navigation? Wireless internet? As soon as we start mapping physical location back into shared information space, we will trigger yet another explosive growth in internet applications. At least, that's what I predict. I could, of course, be wildly wrong. Stuart Brand, in his excellent book, The Clock of the Long Now, proposes keeping a record of society's predictions and arguments in a 10,000-year library. But it will also be interesting to see how things work out in the short term. At the beginning of each new year, the media tend to be full of predictions of what is going to happen over the course of the following year. 2 days later, of course, they're forgotten, and we never get to test them. So I'd like to invite readers to submit their own predictions, or any others they come across in print, of what is going to happen in the next 5 years and when. Will we set off to Mars? Will we get peace in Ireland or the Middle East? Will the e-commerce bubble burst? We'll put them up on the web, where they will stay for that whole period, so we can track them against what actually happens. Predicting the future is a mug's game, but any game is improved when you can actually keep the score. Independent on Sunday. There's now a new generation of smarter office chair beginning to arrive that makes a virtue of doing away with all the knobs and levers. All the springing and bracing we learned about is still there, but it adjusts to your posture and movement automatically without you having to tell it how to. All right, here's a prediction for you. When we have software that works like that, the world will truly be a better and happier place. The Little Computer That Could. My favourite piece of information is that Branwell Bronte, brother of Emily and Charlotte, died standing up, leaning against a mantelpiece, in order to prove it could be done. This is not quite true, in fact. My absolute favourite piece of information is the fact that young sloths are so inept that they frequently grab their own arms and legs instead of tree limbs and fall out of trees. However, this is not relevant to what is currently on my mind because it concerns sloths. Whereas the Branwell Bronte piece of information concerns writers and feeling like death and doing things to prove they can be done, all of which are pertinent to my current situation to a degree that is, frankly, spooky. I'm a writer, and I'm feeling like death, as you would too if you'd just flown into Grand Rapids, Michigan at some ungodly hour of the morning, only to discover that you can't get into your hotel room for another 3 hours. In fact, it's enough just to have flown into Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you are a native of Grand Rapids, Michigan, then please assume that I am just kidding. Anyone else will surely realize that I am not. Having nowhere else to go, I am standing up, leaning against a mantelpiece. Well, a kind of mantelpiece. I don't know what it is, in fact. It's made of brass and some kind of plastic and was probably drawn in by the architect after a nasty night on the town. That reminds me of another favorite piece of information. There is a large kink in the Trans-Siberian Railway. Because when the Tsar, I don't know which Tsar it was, because I'm not in my study at home, I'm leaning against something shamefully ugly in Michigan and there are no books, decreed that the Trans-Siberian Railway should be built, he drew a line on a map with a ruler. The ruler had a nick in it. I am writing this article leaning against some nameless architectural mistake, and I am not writing the article on a Mac. I would, but my PowerBook is fresh out of power. Funny notion to name the thing after its only major shortcoming. It's rather like Greenland, in that respect. I have the power cable with me, but I can't plug it in anywhere. Though the power cable, very cleverly, has a universal power supply, it doesn't have a universal plug. It has a large, clunky, British-style 3-pin plug built right into it, which means that if you forget to buy an adapter plug before you leave Heathrow, you are completely and utterly screwed. You cannot buy an adapter for British plugs outside Britain. I know. I tried that when I ran into a similar problem with the old Mac Portable. I am not going to make any Mac Portable jokes. Apple made quite enough of them to be getting on with. Damn, I said I wasn't going to do that. In the end, I had to buy a US power cable. Or rather, I had to try and buy one. Couldn't be done. They only came with new Mac Portables. I heaved a dead Mac Portable around with me for 10 days, and occasionally ate my sandwiches off it because it was slightly lighter than carrying a table. Damn, there goes another one. I don't have the same problem with my PowerBook, though. I'm not totally stupid. I brought an adapter with me this time. However, I am slightly stupid, because it's in my suitcase, which I've just checked in with the bellman while I wait for 3 hours for my room to be ready. So what am I doing? Handwriting? You must be joking. After 10 years of word processing, I can't even do handwriting anymore. I know I ought to be able to. Handwriting is supposed to be one of those things like using chopsticks. Once you get the hang of it, it never really deserts you. The thing is, I've never had much more practice with chopsticks than pens, so no, I'm not handwriting. I'm not talking into one of those horrible little dictaphones either, which keep on recording relentlessly while you're desperately trying to think of something to say. Pressing the off switch is the thing that turns your brain back on. No. What I'm doing is sitting on a chair somewhere, writing this on a new Psion Series 3A palm-top computer. I got one at the duty-free shop at Heathrow, just for the sheer unadulterated hell of it, and I have to say, it's good. It works. May I just say one thing about duty-free shops before I go on to talk about the Psion? It's not that things aren't cheaper in the duty-free shops. They are. Infinitesimally. You do save a very small amount of money if you shop at them. Of course, you can then lose a very hefty sum of money in fines if you fail to realise that you have to declare anything you've bought duty-free to the customs when you come back into the country. The stuff is only really duty-free if you intend to spend the rest of your life on an aeroplane. So what happens when you buy stuff at the duty-free shop for very slightly less than you would in the high street? It means that most of the money saved on duty is going into the coffers of the duty-free shops rather than helping to pay for the National Health Service and Trident. So why did I buy my Psion at the duty-free shop? Because I'm a complete idiot, that's why. Anyway, status update. They've found me a room. I've unpacked my adapter plug. My PowerBook is charging itself up. I'm still not using it, though because I am now lying in the bath. So I'm still using the Psion. I have never, ever written anything in the bath before. Paper gets damp and steamy. Pens won't write upside down. Typewriters hurt your tummy. And if you are prepared to use a PowerBook in the bath, then I assume that it isn't your own PowerBook. So the thing is, it can be done. You can actually write on a palm-top computer, which is something I didn't realise before. I had tried to do it on a Sharp Wizard, but it wasn't possible because the keyboard was laid out alphabetically, which is hopeless. The principle behind the decision to have an alphabetical keyboard is based on a misunderstanding. I believe that the idea is this. Not everybody knows QWERTY. It's an odd feeling, actually, typing QWERTY as a word. Try it, and you'll see what I mean. But everybody knows the alphabet. This is true, but irrelevant. People know the alphabet as a one-dimensional string, not as a two-dimensional array. So you're going to have to hunt and peck anyway. So why not use QWERTY and let people who know it have the benefit? I also tried the larger Sharp Wizard, the 8200, which does have a QWERTY keyboard, but no word wrap. Can you believe that? Even Etch-A-Sketch has word wrap these days. The other problem with all palm tops is, of course, that the keyboard is too small for your fingers. This is a tricky one. You can't win. If the machine's small enough to go in your pocket, it's too small to type on. Well, I found the answer. Forgive me if you knew this already. Perhaps I'm the last person in the world to find this out. Anyway, the answer is this. You grip the palm top between both hands, and you type with your thumbs. Seriously, it works. It feels a bit awkward to begin with, and your hands ache a little from using unaccustomed muscles, but you get used to it surprisingly quickly. I've clocked up 1,000 words now. Now this raises some interesting questions. Well, interesting to me. You can please yourselves. What about this input business, then? I am, of course, as out of my mind with excitement as the next person about the prospect of voice input and pen input, but you know and I know, and anybody who has fooled around with a Carey typist or the like will know that things rarely work as smoothly in practice as they do in theory, or at least not yet. Most of the time spent wrestling with technologies that don't quite work yet is just not worth the effort for end users, however much fun it is for nerds like us. The days when you can say, "Open pod bay number 2, Hal," and be confident that Hal understands that you want to be stranded on the outskirts of Jupiter, are still a way away, and I suspect that it will be a very long time before I am able to dictate an article like this, and for the result to be even decipherable, let alone accurate. We've all seen the old sketch in which a secretary writes down absolutely everything the boss says, including the bit where he says, "Don't write this bit down," or "cross out the last sentence." I think there's going to be a lot of stupid secretary-type grief to go through before we get it working smoothly. As for pen input devices, well, as I said above, 10 years of word processing has meant that my handwriting has deteriorated to the point where even I can't read it, so what chance of computer stands I really don't know. Can I be bothered to tease out the irony involved in all that? No. So, for the moment, that leaves us back with the keyboard input. And keyboard input, for the moment, means QWERTY. But QWERTY, as we know, was originally designed to slow down typists so the keys wouldn't jam. It's deliberately inefficient. However, all attempts to replace it with something more efficient, like the Dvorak keyboard, have failed. People know QWERTY already, and they don't have any pressing incentive to change. Dvorak et al. May be better, but QWERTY is, or has been till now, good enough. If it ain't bust, don't fix it, is a very sound principle, and remains so, despite the fact that I have slavishly ignored it all my life. I think, though, that we might finally have arrived at a point at which there is a strong incentive to reinvent the keyboard. Palm-top computers are where all the new action is. Apple and Microsoft and everybody are suddenly beginning to get revved up about personal digital assistants and stuff. And having been using this Scion Series 3A for a few hours now, so am I. It's terrific technology, and this is just the beginning. That crucial moment at which something stops being just an entertaining new toy and starts being something you can seriously use in the bath. We've all known for years that QWERTY isn't good. I think we've now got to that important point where it isn't even good enough. I hope that systems designers have not been put off by the failure of the Dvorak keyboard. I hope they are carefully studying the way that people hold palm-top computers, where their fingers naturally fall and fit, and how the whole idea of how a keyboard works can be rethought. I would very much like it if my thumb joints were now not stiff and aching. I've proved it can be done, but, like Branwell Bronte, I'm not expecting to do the same trick again tomorrow. Independent on Sunday. We notice things that don't work. We don't notice things that do. We notice computers. We don't notice pennies. We notice e-book readers. We don't notice books. Little dongly things. Time to declare war, I think, on little dongly things. More of them turned up in the post this morning. I'd ordered a new optical disk drive from an American mail order company, and because I live in that strange and remote place called Foreign, and also because I travel like a pigeon, I was keen to know, when ordering it, if it had an international power supply. An international power supply is the device which means it doesn't matter what country you're in, or even if you know what country you're in. More of a problem than you might suspect. You just plug your Mac in, and it figures it out for itself. We call this principle plug and play. Or at least, Microsoft calls it that because it hasn't got it yet. In the Mac world, we've had it for so long we didn't even think of giving it a name. Nowadays, a lot of peripherals come with international power supplies as well, but not all, which is why I asked. "Yes, it does," said Scott, the sales assistant. "You're sure it has an international power supply?" "Yes," repeated Scott. "It has an international power supply." "Absolutely sure." "Yes." This morning it arrived. The first thing I noticed was that it didn't have an international power supply. Instead, it had a little dongly thing. I have rooms full of little dongly things and don't want any more. Half the little dongly things I've got, I don't even know what gizmo they're for. More importantly, half the gizmos I've got, I don't know where their little dongly thing is. Most annoyingly, an awful lot of the little dongly things, including the one that arrived this morning, are little dongly things that run on 120 volts AC, American voltage, which means I can't use them here in Foreign, state code FN, but I have to keep them in case I ever take the gizmo to which they fit, provided I know which gizmo it is they fit to the USA. What, you may ask, the hell am I talking about? The little dongly things I am concerned with, and they are by no means the only species of little dongly things with which the microelectronics world is infested, are the external power adapters which laptops and palm tops and external drives and cassette recorders and telephone answering machines and powered speakers and other incredibly necessary gizmos need to step down the mains AC supply from either 120 volts or 240 volts to 6 volts DC. Or 4.5 volts DC, or 9 volts DC, or 12 volts DC, at 500 milliamps, or 300 milliamps, or 1200 milliamps. They have positive tips and negative sleeves on their plugs, unless they are the type that has negative tips and positive sleeves. By the time you multiply all these different variables together, you end up with a fairly major industry, which exists, so far as I can tell, to fill my cupboards with little dongly things, none of which I can ever positively identify without playing gizmo Pelmanism. The usual method of finding a little dongly thing that actually matches a gizmo I want to use is to go and buy another, at a price that can physically drive the air from your body. Now, why is this? Well, there's one possible theory. which is just that as Xerox is really in the business of selling toner cartridge, Sony is really in the little dongly power supply business. Another possible reason is that it is sheer blinding idiocy. It couldn't possibly be that, could it? I mean, could it? It's hard to imagine that some of the mightiest brains on the planet, fueled by some of the finest pizza that money can buy, haven't at some point thought, wouldn't it be easier if we all just standardized on one type of DC power supply? Now, I'm not an electrical engineer, so I may be asking for the impossible. Maybe it is a sine qua non of the way in which a given optical drive or CD Walkman works, that it has to draw 600 milliamps rather than 500, or have its negative terminal on the tip rather than the sleeve, and that it will either whine or fry itself if presented with anything faintly different. But I strongly suspect that if you stuck a hardware engineer in a locked room for a couple of days and taunted him with the smell of pepperoni, he'd probably be able to think of a way of making whatever gizmo, maybe even the new Gizmo Pro, which I've heard such good things about, it is he's designing, work to a standard DC low-power supply. In fact, there already is a kind of rough standard, but it's rather an odd one. Not many people actually smoke in their cars these days, and the aperture in the dashboard which used to hold a cigar lighter is now more likely to be powering a mobile phone, CD player, fax machine, or, according to a recent and highly improbable TV commercial, an instant coffee-making gizmo. Because the socket originally had a different purpose. It's the wrong size and in the wrong place for what we now want to do with it, so perhaps it's time to start adapting it for its new job. The important thing this piece of serendipitous pre-adaptation has given us is a possible DC power standard. An arbitrary one, to be sure. But perhaps we should probably just be grateful that it was designed by a car mechanic in an afternoon and not a computer industry standards committee in a lifetime. Keep the voltage level. Design a new small plug, and you have a new standard. The immediate advantage of adopting it would be that you would only need one DC power adapter. Think of that! Well, not exactly one, you might need a dozen of them, but they would all be exactly the same. Just get a box of them. They'll just be a commodity item, like, well, I was going to say light bulbs, but light bulbs come in all sorts of different wattages and fittings. The great thing about having a DC power standard is that it would be much better than light bulbs. Apart from doing away with endless confusion and inconvenience, the arrival of a new standard would encourage all sorts of other new features to emerge. Power points in convenient places in cars, DC power points in homes and offices, and most importantly, DC power points in the armrests of aeroplane seats. I have to own up and say that much as I love my PowerBook, which now does about 97.8% of what I used to use the lumbering old desktop dinosaurs for, I've given up trying to use it on planes. Yes, yes, I know that there are all sorts of power user strategies you can use to extend your battery life, dimming modes, RAM disks, processor resting, and so on, but the point is that I really can't be bothered. I'm perfectly capable of just reading the in-flight magazine if I want to be irritated. However, if there was a DC power supply in my armrest, I would actually be able to do some work, or at least fiddle with stuff. I know that the airline companies will probably say, yes, but if we do that, our aeroplanes will fall out of the sky. But they always say that. I know that sometimes their planes do fall out of the sky, but, and here's the point, not nearly as often as the airline companies say they will. I, for one, would be willing to risk it. In the Great War against little dongly things, no sacrifice, I think, is too great. 1996, Completely Unexpected Productions Limited.